It's time to talk politics. For a roundup of the latest stories, I'm joined now by Rishi Patel from FTI Consulting. Thanks for joining us, Rishi.
Hi, thank you.
So let's start off, I think, with the big news of the day, Labour's Day One EU Nationals pledge. The idea that they're going to say to all EU nationals on day one, day one of being elected, that they're safe.
Exactly. This is a major speech by Keir Starmer, or Sir Keir Starmer, I should say, the shadow Brexit secretary, outlining Labour's position on Brexit, which was meant to kind of be a groundbreaking moment for the party to kind of come up with its, you know, million-dollar question to the Brexit situation. We know that, you know, Labour is in a very difficult situation regarding Brexit, given the complex interplay between the different proponents of and voices within the Labour Party who share very strong views on the topic, often, you know, at odds with each other. You've got, on the one hand, MPs that hold slim majorities in predominantly leave-backing constituencies versus, a core group of Labour MPs who are very strong Remainers. And then similarly, you've got supporters of the party who are kind of within cities who are very pro-Remain, and then those who traditionally vote Labour who are very strong Leavers. So trying to reconcile this is what Labour is having to do, whilst also having putting forward a unique position against Theresa May's Conservatives. So what?
Well, how do you think they're doing then? Does this fulfil all those criteria?
That's the thing. I mean, it's a tricky one. I think the fundamental thing for Labour is to emphasise the importance of guaranteeing workers' rights through the Brexit negotiations, and then also this kind of reciprocal guarantee for the nationals that live abroad, and also the EU nationals that live in the UK, so the British nationals that live abroad and vice versa. So those are the kind of the two things which they're really pushing for as being separate. And then also this idea that if the negotiation doesn't go to plan, that Labour would have the government come back to Parliament, present its negotiating position. If it wasn't satisfactory, would then start the process again. So I think there are a couple of things which are kind of, you know, outlining a slightly different position to what the Conservatives are proposing. But the fundamentals of the argument, i.e. staying within the single market, the fact that, you know, Brexit in itself is happening, are more or less the same. It's a difficult one for Labour, but hopefully this will, you know, do well for them in kind of clarifying their position.
It just reminds me of Labour in the 80s when they thought that unilateral disarmament of nuclear weapons was a good idea and were pushing for that along with CND. And the idea was that, you know, we would give up our nuclear weapons even if the Russians didn't. A lot of people who were sort of a bit more right-wing thought that that was a very bad idea, that you're sort of giving up your negotiating position. And similarly here, there must be a lot of people, I guess, who think that why would we give up one of the cards in our hand, as it were? You know, can't we get a reciprocal agreement that our people in Spain and so on are allowed to stay there if we allow EU nationals to stay here? I guess most people would be of the opinion that EU nationals should be allowed to stay here. But do we actually have to say it overtly straight away without a reciprocal agreement from the EU?
I think that's a very interesting point. I think what this speech is seeking to do is to show that Labour is in support of, kind of the citizens within the UK, and it's an easier position for Labour to take, because I don't particularly think that they think that they're going to win, so they don't actually think that they're going to have to do these negotiations, but they are in the privileged position of being able to say we must guarantee the rights of EU citizens, which, you know, has been called upon by everyone. And as you quite rightly say, it's not something that the government has been calling for in its negotiating position, because they're using EU nationals as a bargaining chip.
We don't have many bargaining chips, do we? Let's face it.
No, I know.
Very few.
If you look at it pragmatically, I can't fathom a situation where you know, it may well be the case, but I can't fathom a situation where the government and, you know, the civil servants around the government could say that we will not guarantee those rights for the citizens that are living here. Either I may be completely, you know, wrong and misled, but everything that I have, you know, read, people I've spoken to in government and in Whitehall, it's kind of everyone knows that that's the position. It's just, as you say, they can't say it out overtly because it's the only thing that they have.
Exactly. It's all we've got. Leave us that. All right, let's move on. Pro-EU Tories quit Open Britain. That's the organisation that sort of followed on from the Remain campaign. Pro-EU Tories have quit, some quite senior Tories, over plans to oust MPs or to try and target MPs who back Brexit. This is quite extraordinary, I think.
Yes, it's interesting. The campaign group Open Britain, which, as you say, kind of was formed out of Britain Stronger in Europe, the Remain campaign, and then other grassroots European organisations like the European Movement, has taken a kind of quite overtly political campaign stance during this election period, saying they will fight, you know, the key 20 seats of the most ardent Brexit-backing MPs that have slim majorities, and then similarly will support MPs who are very pro-Brexit but also have slim majorities. And this has caused issue amongst Tories like Nicky Morgan, Anna Soubry, Dominic Grieve, who have been affiliated with Open Britain and have been calling for continued membership within the single market. I suppose, you know, Open Britain's argument would be, you know, we're not just targeting Conservatives, we're targeting MPs from all sides and all parties. But actually, that's not practically the case. You've got a couple of Labour MPs, Kate Hoey, Gisela Stewart, who they might be targeting. But really, this is an attack on, you know, on senior Conservatives. And it's not surprising that they can't stand for that, because they've also got to, you know, as sad as it is, got to think about their careers and what they're going to be doing after the election. And they can't be part of a group that is against, you know, the Conservative Party, which is, you know, I think it's a shame for Open Britain, because I think they're doing some excellent work, and it's really important that they have representation from within the Conservative Party. But at the same time, if this is the direction that they're going to take, then, you know, it might have more clout as a campaigning organisation rather than just kind of a, you know, a think tank, as it were.
Yes, it seems like they've played the game a little bit dirty there, and as a result, it's kind of backfired really on them.
Yeah.
Oh well. Bad luck, Britain. Better luck next time. Let's move on to, this is fascinating, I think, the very, very rich and powerful former UKIP donor, Aaron Banks, who frankly was, in many people's minds, one of the key architects of the Leave campaign, at least kind of behind the scenes, because he's put so much money behind UKIP in the past and has been such a massive supporter of them. But now, I mean, he's been estranged from them for some time, but now he is accusing the party effectively of being too right-wing, even for him, of declaring war on Muslims, which he thinks is a very bad idea. Maybe it is a very bad idea. It seems like a bad idea to me.
So, you know, the context for this all is UKIP has recently announced a raft of policies, you know, aimed at improving, quote-unquote, integration in British society, which in reality kind of, you know, pick up on these anti-Muslim, but, you know, these issues that many people feel very strongly about, you know, the role of Islam in British society. I think that, you know, if you strip away all the rhetoric and all the situation of what this is just, you know, classic political posturing from someone like Aaron Banks, who has fallen out of favour with the leadership of the of UKIP, and all of a sudden now is, you know, saying that they've got their direction wrong by being too anti-Muslim. But I think in reality he probably would have been on side with what UKIP were doing had he been, you know, a closer part of UKIP.
He's certainly no fan of politicized Islam, but at the same time, some of these things that UKIP are putting forward are really quite extreme, even for them, for the idea of people from particular minority communities, i.e. communities where female genital mutilation may sometimes take place. They want to actually give school children annual checks, annual physical checks. I mean, that is pretty extreme, is it not?
I mean, oh, sorry, I should clarify. I'm not a supporter of UKIP, and I think that that they stand for on the whole is completely
I wasn't suggesting you were, but
it is extreme. I think, but I think what it, and fine, okay, maybe he is saying that they've gone a bit too far, but I think he knows even deep down that the core electorate of UKIP voters, that people are, you know, kind of afraid of a changing Britain and of the role of Islam in the world, and UKIP is if anything being clever in kind of jumping on this kind of broader populist train against, now that they've kind of can't really do as much with the European debate, given that it's kind of all happening and the Tories are kind of leading on that, into the more kind of fringe aspects of it, such as this, and this kind of alludes a lot to what we see with, you know, Donald Trump or with Marine Le Pen, and that's the space that they want to occupy. And it is extreme, and it is a shame, because if that's the direction of where we're going, then it's yet another thing that we have to contend with, a movement away from the centre ground.
Oh, maybe they're just trying to differentiate themselves more from the Conservative Party, I suppose, now that the Tories are all on board with Brexit. I guess they've got to think of something that doesn't sound like the Tory Party.
I think that's exactly true. UKIP is in a state of crisis at the moment. What does it stand for? Are they the party of the working class, or are they the party of free market libertarians? Is it to do with Brexit? Is it to do with, you know, identity? It's, you know, there are all these questions. So I think they're not prepared for the election, and this kind of seems an easy way to kind of win some votes and differentiate themselves, as you say.
Okay, let's move on to Nicola Sturgeon now. This is an interesting one. Support for Scottish independence, according to a new survey, is plummeting in Scotland. That there are far fewer people who support the idea of independence than there were at the time of the previous referendum. That one surprised me. Did it surprise you?
I think it did surprise me that the figures are low. Obviously, we must caveat that, you know, the polls haven't been, you know, the most accurate of predictors in the last couple of huge monumental decisions that we've had in British politics. But, you know, it's not good news for her, because she's already lost one referendum, and her whole argument for proposing the second referendum is that there had been a sea change in opinion as a result of the vote to leave and the fragmentation of the opinion between Scotland and Westminster, and I should say the rest of Scotland and England around the EU issue. And if this polling is indicating that actually people don't want independence and they don't want to have another referendum, then that doesn't, you know, bode well for her. I think, again, though, it's about what the other parties in the opposition can do. In Scotland, the SNP is still, you know, miles ahead and leading the debate. But I think the Scottish Conservatives and, to an extent, Scottish Labour can, if they're clever, pick up on this, these findings and really kind of use them in the campaign. And the SNP is set to lose 9 or 10 seats in the election, and if that could kind of go even a bit further, then that could perhaps even further destabilise the SNP position and make them look like, you know, a less of a credible force in Scottish politics. Having said that, I don't actually think that that's going to happen. I think that she's a very, very strong leader, strong candidate, and she'll pull it through within the bag.
Well, that's why the figures surprised me so much, because she is such a strong leader. Maybe it's to do with the oil price. I guess at the time of the referendum, it looked like Scotland was a strong oil country because the price of oil was so high. It's come down a lot since then. Maybe that's made a lot of Scottish people lose confidence in their ability to be independent. I don't know. Well, anyway,
I also think uncertainty, all of these things, Brexit, this general election, it all kind of, people just want to get on with their daily lives and have an element of stability and know what's going on. And having another thing that further, you know, throws that into the fore. People don't like that on the whole. You know, we're a bit
yeah,
obsessed
there's enough
here, especially
fragmentation
the
as
work
it is.
that I do, where thinking everyone cares so much about you know, all these political decisions. And I'm happy that people do, and that tide is increasing. But the majority of people, as I say, they're just probably a bit like, God, can these people not make their minds up?
Quite. And finally, just a quick word on Marine Le Pen, because she's stepped aside as National Front leader. Now, this is a temporary, some would say slightly desperate move to show that she's a presidential candidate in her own right and no longer also the leader of the party that she's represented all these years. Is it a bit of a strange and unusual move? Is it a necessary move for her to try and desperately wrestle back the chance of the presidency from Macron?
I think it's an absolute show of desperation from her. It was probably pre-planned from the beginning that she would do that as a way to kind of bring together support from others, but she probably wasn't planning on doing it immediately. But as we saw yesterday, all the other mainstream candidates have immediately backed Macron, that's François Fillon and Benoît Hamon, have both said, you know, we endorse this guy. No one has endorsed her. Interestingly, the far left candidate Jean-Luc Mélenchon didn't endorse either of them, which is kind of seen by many as a tacit endorsement of Marine Le Pen. But yeah, I think she needed something to get back in the media game yesterday, because, you know, she wasn't as much as Macron was, and he won. So this was a clever piece of politics from her. But I think hopefully Macron will be able to use this as a, you know, a way to just showcase how desperate she is, because it's very difficult for her to separate herself from the parties and policies of the Front National and saying that she's a president for the whole of France when, you know, the politics of the Front National is extremely divisive and not shared by the whole of France. So I don't know how she's going to actually do it in principle, but in practice. Convince these people that she's any different to what she was the day before yesterday.
Okay, well, that's all we've got time for, so thanks very much for joining me, Rishi. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
That's Rishi Patel there from FTI Consulting. For more on Labour's Day One EU Nationals pledge, I'm now joined by Angus McCulloch of Lancaster University's Law School. Thanks for joining us, Angus.
Good afternoon.
So, Labour's Day One pledge. They say the first thing they're going to do if they get elected, the very first thing, 9 a.m, I think they said. So they won't be getting up particularly early, but at 9 a.m. on the dot, they're going to pledge that all EU nationals, all 3 million of them, can stay here. Just before we get into more depth, just a quick thought from you. Is that a good idea?
It would certainly remove a lot of uncertainty for those 3 million EU nationals that are already here and have lives and jobs here. But also for the British businesses that presumably employ a great many of those EU nationals or family members, UK nationals who have EU nationals as family members. So it would remove a lot of uncertainty and a lot of potential problems from the economy. But whether or not what further impact that would have on the negotiation, that would be another interesting question that we'll have to look at. Wait and see what happens.
Well, it would be an incredible scenario if we allowed 3 million people from Europe to stay here, but then it turned out that the EU said that all the British people on the Costa del Sol had to go home again.
Yes, that would be unusual, but it's probably unlikely. If you look at the Commission's draft negotiation documents, one of the things that they suggest that they would be seeking to do would be to try and find some sort of reciprocal arrangement for those UK nationals in the EU and EU nationals in the UK. So their position is to try and seek some form of reciprocal arrangement. The problem with that at the moment is that the UK government have refused to sort of make any commitments to that in advance, and they want to wait for the negotiation before they will start discussing that. So it shouldn't be an enormous problem, and be difficult to see that you'd have millions of people being expelled from one to the other come Brexit Day. That would probably be a very surprising result.
Well, I was just talking about this to Rishi Patel from FTI Consulting, and I was suggesting that we really don't have many bargaining chips in this whole EU negotiation thing. And this is one of them. And it's one of those things where we all know that there's no way we're going to send 3 million EU nationals back to their various countries in Europe. It's simply not going to happen. But do we have to actually spell it out overtly, because it's one of the only things that we have to negotiate with, or to kind of give us any strength in these negotiations, even if we don't refer to it directly?
I'm not sure it gives us a position of strength, really. In the fact that we've got so many more, they're active, they're economically active, they pay more in tax than they receive in benefits. So essentially, we would be damaging our own economy if we were to expel them. So there's no advantage to saying we'll do something stupid and costly, because you might do something else that will probably cost you slightly less.
It's kind of like the nuclear threat, isn't it? It's like we know we're never going to cause Armageddon with nuclear weapons, and we don't even have to talk about using them. But the very fact that they exist gives us a certain strength that perhaps we wouldn't otherwise have. Likewise, we know that we're not going to send 3 million EU nationals home. It wouldn't be in anybody's best interest, not theirs, but not ours either. And yet, by not explicitly saying we're going to allow them all to stay, that gives us a bit of extra strength, doesn't it? Or am I thinking about this a little bit too deeply?
I think the art of negotiation is not quite like playing poker. It's you don't necessarily have to keep your hand a secret in order to do well in negotiation. I think the power is in having a sensible position, a good offer to the other side, and simply keeping it quiet what you think is maybe not the best way forward. It just creates uncertainty, and it creates a position whereby everyone's being cagey and no one talks. It's not necessarily the best way to get forward, particularly when you have a very contracted timescale and a very, very complicated problem to try and deal with.
This is true. And Labour is suggesting that, in fact, we really need to have a sort of better relationship with the EU for the negotiations to sort of work well in our favour, and that this would be a real goodwill pledge that would kind of change the whole tenor of the debate. Do you think that they've got a point in saying that?
I think there is something to be said for that. It's an easy win, you know, to say that we are being magnanimous and we're doing a gesture. Even if the government were to go as far as he's not miss a pledge saying, but we would really want this. This is something we really want and we were trying to achieve. That's not making a commitment, but at least it sends the right signal to the people who are here that the UK government is not actively seeking to get rid of you. One of the problems at the moment is that a lot of EU nationals who are trying to apply for permanent residency to try and secure their position somewhat are being told, you know, if they put in their application and something is wrong, they get a letter back from the Home Office saying that prepare to leave. Which is not very helpful. So it's language is important, and the way that the government presents its the way it wants to deal with EU nationals in the UK is important. And at the moment, they're not going out of their way to make anyone's life easy or comfortable. And it's not necessarily a very comforting position if you're in that.
Now, Labour are clearly trying to separate themselves from the Tories policy-wise with not just this particular pledge, but also saying that they would want to stay in the single market, and they would want the existing customs agreements to kind of stay in place if at all possible as well. But then the Tories counter by saying, well, that's not really a Brexit at all, is it? What's your opinion? Is it a Brexit?
Well, as we all know, Brexit means Brexit, which means nothing. So, yes, what is a Brexit is the question we've been asking ourselves since the referendum campaign was announced. And I don't think we're much closer to finding out an answer. Everyone has their own version of Brexit. If Brexit just means leaving the EU as an organisation, is that our membership as it is now ceases to be as it is now, then we will have a Brexit. I think Labour have not said that they want to remain a member of the EU and all the rights and obligations that stem from that. So they want to leave the EU as an organisation, but that doesn't necessarily mean they want to leave the single market or the customs union. Norway is not a member of the EU, but it is a member of the single market. It's not a member of the customs union, but there are differential ways of associating yourself with the EU. I would say that as being a different form of Brexit.
It's tricky because I may be wrong in this, but my sense is that when half the country or more than half the country voted to leave the EU, in a lot of those people's minds, one of the things that Brexit involved would be a very different situation with regard to immigration. And we all know that if we keep the single market and we keep the customs union, then like Norway, we're going to more or less keep the situation we have regarding the amount of immigration that we have. So for a lot of those voters, they would feel let down, wouldn't they?
Possibly they might, but at the same time, the same politicians that were talking about immigration were saying there was no question of us leaving the single market at the same time. You know, so there was no consistent position on this. The Leave campaign was very squarely on what the single market was. They were quite clear about immigration, but then they were clear that the single market wasn't able. The single market hasn't existed for a long time. It's now called the internal market. You know, so the language that was used was very indeterminate. It was very difficult to work out exactly what people were pledging. The Leave side were coming up with saying all sorts of different things at the same time. So with the government, and so with the Remain side, they were saying lots of different things as well. But it was very difficult to pin down what any of this meant. And the customs union was hardly talked about at all pre-referendum. But it becomes immediately important after the referendum, well, because it's a very important part of the way British business does business. If you look at, for instance, car components, they go back and forward, you know, talking British car manufacturers and how important they are to the British industry. The components go back and forward across the channel all the time. And if you're not in the customs union, that becomes incredibly hard to do and logistically difficult.
Yeah, indeed. Well, it looks like people have got a choice between, so they've got the Tories with the hard Brexit, Labour with the soft Brexit, Liberal Democrats with the no Brexit whatsoever. They've got quite a choice to make. Thanks very much for joining us, Angus.
Thank you.
That's Angus McCulloch there of Lancaster University's Law School.